The monster blood changed direction, still bouncing and quivering and leaving white stains on the grass like enormous round footsteps.
Joe, stop reading it. This is too scary for me.
You're right. It is too scary.
If only we could talk about Goosebumps in a way that isn't scary.
Well, guess what, nerds? There might be a podcast like that called Geesebumps.
Geesebumps?
Did you mean Goosebumps?
Maybe. Geesebumps is a comedy podcast based on the works of R.L. Stein, hosted by me, Danielle. PhD.
And me, JoJo PhD.
And me, Jeff, regular person.
Featuring goofs, funny voices, and the occasional critical thought.
Geesebumps!
Available on Podbean and everywhere else podcasts can be found.
It's scary time. Lock your doors, check under the bed, and turn on a nightlight because it's time for the scariest stories, history, and conversations ever heard. Every week, an independent creator tells us about the paranormal, ghosts, monsters, hauntings, creepy places, enchanted objects, aliens, and more. Best of all, if you like the creator, you can follow them for more great content, if you dare. Search for Scary Time by Indie Drop-In, wherever you stream podcasts. Welcome to Reverie True Crime. As always, I'm your host, Paige. Today, I'll be telling you about the only woman in Australia sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Her name is Catherine Knight. I hope you had something to eat before you listen to this episode, because I guarantee you won't be too hungry afterwards. Buckle up and let's get started. Catherine Mary Knight was born on the 24th of October, 1955, to her mother Barbara and father Ken, in the Tenterfield Hospital. The hospital is located in northwestern New South Wales. Her mother had just given birth to Catherine's twin sister, Joy, 30 minutes before Catherine. She also had an older brother named Charlie, who had the same father as Joy and Catherine. Barbara had previously been married to a man named Jack, and they had four boys together named Patrick, Martin, Neville, and Barry. Barbara actually met Ken through Jack, which was the talk of the town. When Barbara and Jack divorced, Patrick and Martin, the eldest sons, were staying with Jack. The youngest of the children went to Sydney to live with their aunt. In 1959, Jack passed away, and this is when the eldest sons moved in with their mother. In 1961, Catherine's mom, Barbara, and Ken had another baby, a son who they named Shane. Needless to say, Catherine had a pretty big family, but it wasn't quite the picture-perfect one at all. Ken used to rape Barbara many times a day, and he was a vicious alcoholic. Catherine claims that she was sexually assaulted by various family members, but not her dad, until she was 11 years old. Barbara would tell her girls all about her sex life and how much she detested sexual intercourse and all men. Catherine came to her mother one day and told her that her partner wanted to have sex, and she didn't. Barbara flat out told her that she needed to put up with it and stop whining about it. Barbara's great-grandmother was an Indigenous Australian who was married to an Irishman. Barbara proudly identifies as Aboriginal. However, it was very hush-hush, and not many people even knew because of the racism in the area that they lived in at the time. Catherine was close to her twin sister, Joy, and she was also really close to her champion horseman uncle, Oscar Knight. He completed suicide in 1969, and Catherine still says his spirit is around her and always has been since his death. As a child, Catherine was said by some to be such a kind and loving girl who was great with animals, and she only had one issue when she was 13, and she had to go to children's court for a trivial charge. She got a good conduct bond. However, others say that she was the school bully to younger tots, beating up a schoolmate with a weapon of some kind, and she attacked a teacher. The teacher acted in self-defense and injured Catherine. She never learned how to read or write. At the age of 15, she dropped out of school to work at a clothing plant. Her father, Ken, labored at slaughterhouses, and he moved around with the family all around Queensland and New South Wales. He worked extensive hours wherever he could find work. In 1969, Ken, Barbara, and their six kids finally decided to live in Aberdeen. Ken secured a job at a slaughterhouse there that was more consistent, and he wouldn't have to move around to find work now. Due to Ken being employed at a slaughterhouse, that's also what Catherine sought to do when she got older. She thought the aroma of dead animals was like a beautifully scented perfume. When she turned 16, she would go to the slaughterhouse with her dad, Joy, and Charlie to bone out the animals' corpses. She first started out chopping the heads off of swine before she started gutting dead carcasses. Catherine was around men all the time at the slaughterhouse, and she became one of the boys. She was fierce at the time and didn't back down from any man. She would trash talk with the guys, and she'd always get the best of them. Not only could she verbally take up for herself at any time, but if anybody came at her in a threatening way, she'd always have her knife ready. She'd go at them and threaten to scrap with any of them if they wanted to mess with her or make her feel less than. None of the men were ever ballsy enough to step up to Catherine. She loved her collection of gutting butcher knives, and she kept them hanging above her bed at night. David Kellett was a 22-year-old truck driver that Catherine fell head over heels for in 1973. She moved in with David the minute she turned 18. David wasn't much better than her father. He was a domestic abuser and addicted to the bottle. His drinking was said to start when his best friend was killed in an accident when he was arranging locomotive inventory into a train. Not only that, but he witnessed a train hit a school bus in 1968, which left six children dead. He eventually lost his job because he would fall asleep on the job, and alcohol was really affecting his work. So Catherine and David get together, and he would often fistfight Catherine, but he soon realized she was a tough broad and could do more to him than just throw fists, and he was the weaker of the two. However, they did wed a year later, after Catherine talked him into it. After they got married, that night she tried to choke David to death because he wouldn't have sex with her multiple times. She had burned his face with a hot iron at some point as well. They already had sex three times, and David fell into a deep slumber. Catherine wasn't ready to go to bed. She wanted another round of sex. She was angry that he was tired, which is when she started to strangle him. He woke up one time with her sitting on top of him, a knife to his throat. Catherine was laughing, telling him how simple it would be to murder him right there. She even asked him if it was true that truck drivers have a woman in every town. Eventually, David started working at the slaughterhouse as well. He was the one who had to kill the pigs, and whenever he would use a stun gun on the swine, Catherine loved to run over and observe it almost every time. The marriage was super chaotic. David cheated on Catherine all of the time and would leave in the middle of the night to go be with other women. Despite that, David and Catherine would go on to have a baby together. While Catherine was pregnant, David came home late from playing darts one night, and she beat him in the back of the head with a frying pan for it, as well as burned all of his clothes and shoes. Their baby was born in May of 1976, a baby girl that they named Melissa Ann. It wasn't long after Melissa was born that David ran off with another lady after being married to Catherine for 10 years. He moved to Queensland to live with the new woman because he said he couldn't take Catherine's behavior anymore. Catherine was jealous, selfish, controlling, violent, and terribly irritable. David wasn't the victim here either. He was an abusive alcoholic and was drunk all of the time. Catherine's own mother even told him that she knew Catherine had a screw loose and a horrid anger problem. After David was gone, Catherine's violent nature increased severely. David stated, quote, "The old girl, meaning Barbara, said to me to watch out. You better watch this one or she'll fucking kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do the wrong thing and you're fucked. Don't ever think of playing upon her. She will fucking kill you." And that was her mother talking. "She told me she's got something loose. She's got a screw loose somewhere." End quote. Catherine had no one to take her rage, anxiety, depression, and revenge out on except Melissa, her 2-month-old. She placed Melissa into her little stroller, took her to a railroad, and put her on the tracks so a train would run over the defenseless baby. Thankfully, there was a man close by, and he heard the wailing cries of Melissa. Heroically, he ran over and saved her. The exact same day this happened, she went into complete mad woman mode and started swinging an axe that she had stolen around in the air, terrorizing people, saying she was going to kill them. Catherine was fortunately arrested, and the police admitted her into St. Elmo's Hospital, located in Tamworth, where she stayed for a few months. After they established Catherine had postpartum depression, she was free to sign herself out and go. Even though, while she was in the psychiatric hospital, she told more than one nurse that she wanted to murder a mechanic that fixed David's vehicle, because that was what allowed him to leave her. Only a few days after she left the hospital, she took a butcher knife to a woman's face, a woman that she knew, and sliced this woman's face, threatening her and telling her to take her to David. This woman was bleeding so bad while driving Catherine. They pulled into a gas station, and this is when the woman managed to jump out of the car and get away. The police were called by the owner of the gas station, who was completely hysterical. The police arrived to a terrifying scene. Catherine was holding a baby boy hostage by his shirt and waving a knife around. The cops grabbed a few brooms they had easy access to, and they started beating Catherine with the brooms and gripped onto her until she dropped the little boy and the knife. The authorities were able to get the boy and get him out of her reach. A local doctor said that she needed to be admitted into Morisset Psychiatric Hospital and detained. She was to be treated and be watched closely as well. Her baby girl was given to her parents at the time she was in the hospital. David was now driving a truck for a living in Queensland. The authorities let him know that Catherine was under heavy sedation at the mental facility and was placed in the psych ward. David and his mom, Jean, went to see his Catherine. She was in absolute heaven when she saw him. Catherine was able to leave the mental institution on the 9th of August, 1976. She was able to be in Jean's care under one condition. Jean had to make sure that Catherine took her medicines. On the way to Jean's house, they picked up baby Melissa. It was only a few weeks later that Catherine and David rented a small house together in Woodridge, which is in Queensland. David continued to be a truck driver, while Catherine got employed at Denmore Meatworks, where she did what she did best, gutting the corpses of animals. To no one's surprise, when David and Catherine were back together, the relationship was tumultuous. Catherine was more violent than ever, usually for no reason. She'd beat the hell out of David, not only with her fist, but anything she could grab in the moment. Catherine and David obviously had an extremely toxic relationship, which should have ended a long time ago, but they went on to have another baby together. On the 6th of March, 1980, their baby was born. They named her Natasha Marie. Around 1984, David came home from work one evening, and Catherine and the two girls, they were nowhere to be found, and the house was completely empty. Come to find out, she'd moved back to her parents' farm in Aberdeen, and she was also back to working at the slaughterhouse. Living under her parents' roof didn't last long at all. She eventually moved out with the kids and rented a place in Musselbrook, which isn't too far from Aberdeen. About a year later, she had to quit working because she started having severe back problems, which was due to bending over all the time at the slaughterhouse. The government fixed Catherine up with a house in Aberdeen. The situation was great because the house was really close to the kids' school and she was getting a regular disability check as income. Since she had broken up with her husband, she tried dating a bit. It just wasn't working out for her in the dating department for a while. In 1986, she met a 38-year-old mine worker named Dave Saunders at a hotel. He was from Scone. He was said to be a great guy, with his only downfall being that he drank a good bit. Catherine was very happy and had a way of making Dave fall head over heels for her. He also loved the fact that she wanted to have sex all the time. For a few months, they were in that honeymoon stage of a relationship. Everything seemed so grand and wonderful. Dave settled in with Catherine, Melissa, and Natasha while still keeping his apartment in Scone. The honeymoon phase of their relationship soon fizzled out as Catherine started accusing Dave of cheating on her when allegedly he wasn't. It was her paranoia and jealousy that made her wonder what he was doing when he wasn't at home. When she started hounding him about all of this all of the time, their relationship just completely went downhill from there. Dave would be kicked out of the house, back to his apartment in Scone. Every time he would get settled back into his place, here Catherine would come, begging him to come back, and unfortunately, he would follow her like a lost puppy back to her place every single time. As with her ex-husband, Catherine would abuse Dave with her fists and boots. In May of 1987, things would steadily get worse. Catherine told him that if he ever cheated on her, saying this as she cut the throat of Dave's puppy, then knocking the puppy in the head with a frying pan until it died, right in front of him, that is basically what would happen to him. Despite this, Dave loved Catherine. No matter how chaotic and violent things got, even with Catherine attempting to kill herself, Dave didn't want to give up on her. The next year, they had a baby together in June named Sarah. When Sarah was born, things actually started to get better. So much better, in fact, Dave put money down on a house on McQueen Street in Aberdeen. In 1989, Catherine was able to pay off the house completely. It wasn't the biggest house, but it was perfect for their little family. Catherine was able to decorate the house however she wanted, and she decked it out in pure Catherine style. Cowhides on the walls, water buffalo and bull horns, furs, as well as sheep and cow skulls and deer antlers. That's not all. She had a stuffed peacock and a stuffed fawn. Hanging from the beams of the ceiling were rusted animal traps, forks, spoons, motorcycle jackets, leather coats, pitchforks, a rusty rake, boots, horse crop and saddle. Every nook and cranny in the house was stuffed with clothes, books, and newspapers. She also had a huge collection of horror movies. Needless to say, she finally had her dream home. New baby, new house, festooned with all of her favorite things, the happiness, of course, wore off. The violence fired back up. She stabbed Dave in the stomach with scissors and beat him over the skull with an iron. Dave took off back to Scone to his apartment because he thought he had finally had enough. After only a week, he was back at the house with Catherine and the kids because she invited him over, and as usual, he couldn't resist the invitation. When he showed up, to his surprise, he discovered that all of his clothes were shredded and torn by Catherine and then taken to the dump. Well, that was Dave's breaking point, finally. He left. He took all of the leave from his mining job and went into hiding. Catherine searched near and far for Dave, but she couldn't find him. She was angry because his friends knew exactly where he was, but they weren't going to tell her no matter what. Catherine, finally realizing she wasn't going to find Dave, threw in the towel. She then went to the police station and told them that she was in fear of her life if Dave were to ever come back. The authorities issued an apprehended violence order against Dave so he couldn't legally see the kids or her. Now, Dave had no idea about this, and a few months later, he had been missing his daughter Sarah so much that he went to see her, but quickly found out that he couldn't. In total Catherine fashion, she was in a relationship within months and got pregnant. She had a son in 1991 named Eric by 43-year-old John Chillingworth. Not shocking at all that he worked at the slaughterhouse in Aberdeen. Their relationship lasted 3 years, and she left John Chillingworth for another John, John Price. She had been cheating on John Chillingworth with John Price for a long time. She met him in 1993 at a hotel. They were both 38 years old at the time, and the affair was the best thing that could have ever happened to John Chillingworth, to be honest. He straightened up, got his life together, and lived happily ever after, unlike John Price. Everyone described John Price, also known as Pricey, as a great man who would do anything in the world for anyone. He'd been married previously, and he had 3 children. The ex-wife took the baby when they split in 1988. She left him to raise 2 teenagers. He owned his own little house on St. Andrew Street in Aberdeen. He also made excellent money as a mine worker. Catherine and the children were spoiled and had everything they ever needed or wanted. John had heard about how violent Catherine could be, but he brushed it off, because he really liked her, and his kids did as well. They moved in together in 1995. As always, in the beginning, Catherine seemed like the perfect, loving lady. She would always make the meals, cater to her man, and drove him home from the hotel when he was so drunk he couldn't walk. He loved that she was super spicy in the bedroom, too. Catherine couldn't hide who she really was for long. Eventually, she would treat him the way she did every other man. It went the exact same way, including the breakups and getting back together. Catherine was living in John Price's home on St. Andrew Street, and everything was escalating. The abuse, the accusations, splitting up, getting back together. They would go to local hotels to have one drink too many, and people would just watch their awful fights. Everyone always saw them fighting, even at John's home in the front yard or in the street at times. It was a very toxic relationship, just like all of the others. In 1998, Catherine wanted John Price to marry her, but he always refused to. They had a major physical fight over this, and he took a belt and gave her quite the lashing. Well, that was it. She was fed up. In an act of revenge, she knew John had stolen some things from his job. She videotaped all of these items he had stashed and took the tape to his boss to rat him out. These were items that had already gone out of date or were pilfered from the garbage, but they still fired John for it. He had worked there for 17 years and loved that job. So John kicked her out of his house and she went back to her house full of dead carcasses. That only lasted a few months because John wanted her back, just not back into his house. They were back together, which caused the majority of John's friends to avoid him at all costs when Catherine was with him. They didn't want anything to do with that toxic situation. It didn't take long for the fights to ramp back up again. They'd always fight about John losing his job and have these insane drunken fights over nothing and everything all at once. Nothing could tear these two apart, and it was obvious to everyone in the town that something extremely bad was going to happen to one of them someday. Catherine even told her dad, Ken, in January of 2000 that she was going to kill Pricey. On the 29th of February 2000, a violent fight ensued in the kitchen, and Catherine grabbed a knife. She began to stab John in the chest. That same day, he went to the Scone Magistrate's Court and got an apprehended violence order taken out on Catherine so she couldn't be anywhere near him. He even told his co-workers that if he didn't show up at work, it's because Catherine killed him. Everyone was begging him not to go home, but he said he was terrified that if he didn't go home, Catherine would murder his children. John came home and the kids were not there. He found out that Catherine wasn't at the house, but she told the kids to go sleep over at a friend's place. Sometime during that day, Catherine had purchased black lingerie because she had plans later that night. She videoed her children while talking, and it's speculated that she was basically making her will in that video. The violence order didn't stop her. That night, John was settled in bed after he had visited his neighbors. It was around 11 at night when he heard someone pull in the driveway. Of course, it's Catherine, and she invites herself inside. She plops down on the sofa, watches TV, and then helps herself into his shower. Then she changes into her sexy new black lingerie and jumped into bed with John, which did lead to them having sex. While John was sleeping like a baby, she took a butcher knife. Obviously, this woke him up, and he tried to get away as Catherine ran after him all over the house. He got to the door and made it outside. Then he either fell backwards inside of the house or he was pulled back by Catherine. She drug him into the hallway where he bled out from being stabbed 37 times all over his body. Many of his vital organs were pierced and he died. A little while later, Catherine went to an ATM and took out $1,000 from John's account. It was a few hours after John's death when Catherine skinned him and hung his skin like cowhide on a meat hook at the top of the doorframe that led into the living room. She severed John's head and mutilated his whole body, cooking some of the parts, which she severed, with baked potatoes, pumpkin, beetroot, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy. She made this human and food mixed meal on two plates for John's kids. She set the table and put a note beside each plate with the kids' names written on them. There was a third plate, but it was found dumped outside. It's alleged that Catherine probably tried to eat the meal, but she couldn't and threw it outside. John's head was in a pot of vegetables. Catherine set up what was left of John's body, laying his arm over an empty soda pop bottle while she crossed his legs. She also set a note on top of a picture of John, which was bloodstained and had skin on it. Remember, Catherine couldn't read or write very well at all, so the note was all misspelled, but it basically said, quote, "Time got you back, Jonathan, for raping my daughter. You too, Beck," which is John's daughter, "for Ross, for little John. Now play with little John's dick, John Price," end quote. There was no evidence to back up anything that was said in this note. At 6 in the morning, John's neighbor noticed that John's car was still at home, and he'd usually be gone to work by now. John's boss sent one of the employees over to his house because they knew something wasn't right, especially after what John had told them if he didn't show up to work. The neighbor and co-worker banged on John's bedroom window after calling the police. They saw there was blood on the front door. The police got there around 8 in the morning and broke down the back door. They found Catherine unconscious from taking a ton of pills. Then the police discovered everything else. The pot that John's head was in, it was still warm when they got there. Thankfully, the children were at school and all of this was found out early before the children could find it. The police report states that Catherine was taken out of the house right away by police, and later she was taken to the hospital by ambulance. The amount of bloody handprints, pools of blood, and the bloody imprints on the carpets of body parts was unimaginable. Most of the people that were on the scene that day are still haunted by all of the things that they saw. This is the autopsy report by forensic pathologist Dr. Timothy Lyons, and it says the victim was dead when he was skinned. A razor-sharp knife had been inserted just under his collarbone and sliced horizontally across the top of the body, from shoulder to shoulder, right under the clavicles. It was a straight, clean cut, anatomically precise. Then the knife was turned and cut down the chest and over the stomach to the pubic hairline and made into a T with another straight line. Tracing the knife tip around his pubic area and careful not to cut his penis or genitals, the killer cut down the front of John Price's thighs, over the knees, and to his feet. The killer then moved up the body, held his arms up, and cut down the back of each one and across the top of the victim's head. The killer then peeled the victim's skin off, including his head, his hair, his face, and all the way down the length of his body to the feet, exposing the victim's intestines. The entire skin was in one piece, including the hair, face, ears, nose, mouth, genitals, and complete stab holes and dripping blood. Hanging from the S-hook in the doorway, the feet were dragging on the ground. The killer then removed the victim's head clean at the C3-C4 junction, right at the top of the shoulders using a very sharp knife. The cut was precise and clean. The killer would have been covered in warm, sticky blood. The whole procedure would have taken about 40 minutes. Also, there are 3 videotapes of the crime scene, but they will never be released for anyone to see. A lot of people quit that day, and most have PTSD from the sights of something you'd only see in a horrific movie. So when Catherine was interrogated, She said she didn't have any memory beyond having sex with John that night. She told investigators, quote, "He wanted sex, so we had it. He was gentle and kind, and afterwards he went to the toilet. He was walking back to bed, and that's it," end quote. On the 6th of March, 2000, she was charged for the murder of John Price while she was in a psych ward. Catherine at first pleaded not guilty. This would mean the family, the jury, and everyone there would have to look at every bit of evidence, which would cause so much trauma, as it already had to many people that were on the crime scene. So, Justice Barry O'Keefe told 60 of the possible jurors that they could leave due to the photographic evidence being extremely horrible. 5 potential jurors did leave. The trial was in October of 2001. Catherine pleaded guilty. Even the psychiatrist said she was completely sane when she murdered John. A lot of psychiatrists agreed that she could have slight amnesia or dissociation, but that she still was sane. This also was a relief that the family and everyone else didn't have to go through the horror of seeing the photographs and all of the other evidence collected. November 8, 2001. Catherine was told she would spend life in prison without even the slightest opportunity for parole. Her papers were even marked, quote, "never to be released." She has tried to appeal the sentence in 2006, saying her time she is to spend in prison is too long for what she did. Of course, it was thrown out. She may have pleaded guilty, but she still says she doesn't remember a single thing. Even at the sentence hearing, Catherine's lawyers begged for her to be out of the room when he read the facts of the murder, but that was denied and she had to sit and listen. Some think, after she tried to eat a piece of John, it was so disturbing to her that maybe she had blocked it out of her mind, but who really knows? When the details came up about the skinning of John's body, decapitation, among all of the other horrendous things she did, Catherine went into hysterics and they had to sedate her. Catherine turned 65 this past October. As of February 2020, Catherine, then 64, still has a visitor, John Chillingworth. He said that she is doing better than ever. She's in the Silverwater Women's Correctional Center, where other inmates referred to her as the Nana. John Chillingworth told the Daily Mail in Australia, quote, "She seems more relaxed and more confident in herself. She just seems different. She goes to see a psychiatrist regularly, and over the years she's done a lot of self-improvement work. The last time I visited her in Silverwater was about 18 months ago. We spoke about family, old times, what she's been doing in prison, and what she's been doing to get well. She does pottery class, and she's pretty good at it. She likes painting. She seems to be calmer and mixes with the other girls. It's like a big dormitory, but she gets on with everyone. They call her Grandma. She's aged a bit, well, a hell of a lot, actually. She looks older in the face, and her hair, it's not fiery red, it's gray now. She's also put on a little weight," end quote. John Chillingworth said that he was never scared the 3 years they were together. The son that they had together is his reasoning for visiting Catherine. He said he doesn't want their son to grow up without a mother. Of their time together, he said, quote, "It was hard at times, rough. She could be very angry and do crazy things, but nothing to that extent, never. She claimed in court that I assaulted her regularly, but it was false. The only time was once when she grabbed me on the face and broke my glasses, so I gave her a backhander," end quote. Catherine is still hopeful that one day they will allow her to have a chance at parole. John Chillingworth went on to say, quote, She would like to get out for her children's sake and to meet her new grandchildren. She would love that. Is she a threat to society? No, I don't believe so. Not from what I can make out. But would society accept her being released? I would say no. At first, I found it hard to believe that she couldn't remember killing John. But when I thought about it, something that horrific, do you just black out? When she realized the severity and the reality of what she had done, she wanted to kill herself. She was horrified. Everyone made Pricey out to be some angel, but Pricey was never an angel. What happened to him was the worst imaginable. It was horrific, but it was a volatile relationship. I knew him well, years before he was seeing Catherine. I think everyone deserves a second chance. End quote. According to new.com.au, it was reported that since she was arrested, she found religion, she knits, and acts as a queen bee, trying to make everyone get along and sort out any fights or arguments others have with each other. The officers in the prison don't trust her, and they always have an eye on her. She's obviously not permitted to be around knives, and she has to be in a cell by herself just in case she ever did decide to murder again. This is an excerpt from James Phelps' book called Green is the New Black. He spoke with prison officers who oversee Catherine and with former penthouse pet model Victoria Shimbri, who became Knight's prison friend. In the book, Victoria says, quote, a typical day for Knight starts at 7 a.m. every morning when she wakes to go to one of the most tedious jobs in prison. She makes headphones. That's her job. She's stuck in a factory every day from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. making headphones on a big loud machine. She gets through more work than anyone. She enjoys her job and takes pride in what she does. Knight is said to be one of the best workers in the headphone factory and commands the top wage. Four guards flank her. They watch her every move and are with her every day. Her cell is the same size as every other cell in the wing. It's a one-out corner cell at the end of the wing. She has a bed, clothes, and the centerpiece of her room is a big old table that she uses for making art. She also sits at that table to write letters. Her room is very cluttered. She had shit everywhere. She had been there for a long time, and it was like she'd kept everything she'd ever been given. Not many people ever got to go in her room. She keeps it very private. I was in there only once to help her lift something she couldn't lift on her own. It was her private space. She crochets and has heaps of blankets and things that she's made. There's wool piled everywhere. She has tried to make it as homely and warm as possible. She's going to be there until she dies, so she has made it her home, a place that she feels comfortable in. Knight is also a prison artist. She has become a skilled painter and raises money for the prison by selling her works. She's an incredible artist. But she never signs anything that she does, and never will. She doesn't want anyone making money off of her name because she killed someone. She doesn't want some sick person buying her art because they think what she did was cool. The thought of someone hanging something on their wall just because she is a killer repulses her. She's amazing with a pencil, paint, and also pottery. A lot of her pottery is on display in the foyer at Malawa. She has allowed them to sell a lot of it to raise money for charity and the jail without her signature, of course. We call her the Nana. She is a gentle soul and not a criminal to me. She's a mediator. She's someone who sorted out problems before they got serious. She would pull the girls in and try to get them to sort out whatever it was before it ended up with someone going into segregation or getting more time added to their sentence. She would stop girls from stealing from each other, and stop girls from fighting. But she never did it by standing over anyone. She never raised her hands to anyone. She was just someone who everyone loved. She organizes a big catch-up every Friday. She organizes all the food and makes sure that everyone in the wing is a part of it. She includes every single person, even those she doesn't really like. She does it to bring everyone together. It stops a lot of problems from happening. End quote. So in the book, an officer said, quote, "She's the top boss of the jail. She takes no crap from anyone and absolutely gives it to the guards. If you come in to search her cell, she will stand in front of you with a smug face and scream at you. She will demand to watch you search the cell, and she will not leave the area. She'll scream, 'No, I'm fucking staying here.' You have to use force to get rid of her, so we just leave her there and tell her to watch. It isn't worth the hassle, and every time you pick up something, she'll be like, 'What are you touching that for?' She is the other inmates' confidant. They all go to her to talk and ask permission for whatever it is they want to do. She knows everything that goes on in the jail, and whatever she says goes. She has never raised her hands in prison, not once. I think she has that level of respect because of her crime, because she was so brutal. She has a lot of respect in the inmate population, that's for sure. They simply do not fuck around with her, and that's a fact. Most of the other heavies get respect for being tough. Other criminals fear them. But Knight doesn't really have a record of violence while in jail. I would actually say she hasn't even had a single jail charge since she's been inside. Even the guards respect her a bit. She's the boss, put it that way. She would be the boss of any pod. She'll always be classified high risk. She will never go to a place like Emu Plains, where she can see trees or walk in a field. She can never have a job mowing lawns or where she can leave the jail. She will always be locked in a factory because everyone thinks she's a heartless, callous monster. But she has emotions. I've seen them. I've seen her cry. She is no monster, but she'll always be caged like one." End quote. Green is the New Black by James Phelps is available wherever you can purchase books. Thanks for listening, and congratulations if you made it through this horrendous episode. It's definitely something I can't wrap my mind around, that this actually happened and it isn't some crazy scary movie. The fact that anyone is capable of doing something so disgusting and evil is hard to comprehend. But people like Catherine exist in this world. That is why we always have to be careful. If you're with someone that abuses you in any way, please do anything you can to get yourself out of that situation. I know it's easier said than done, from my own personal experiences. In the domestic violence episodes I did, there are hotlines in the show notes that you can call in every country for help, as well as tips for loved ones of people in abusive relationships. To John Price's family, I definitely send my deepest condolences. I can't imagine the pain and heartbreak that this family must feel. Before I go, I do want to thank my patrons over at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Thank you, Lorraine, Emily, Liz, Shayna, Denise, Madeline, Trevor, Maggie, Melissa, Chelsea, Ian, and Brandy. Thanks so much for supporting myself and the podcast. For $3 a month, you'll get different merch in the mail periodically, early access and ad-free episodes before they come out on the podcast, Patreon-exclusive episodes that you can vote on, pictures that are related to the episodes before anyone else, and more. Check out the $3 tier and see what you think. Thanks so much for supporting however you choose to. I hope you all have a great day or night wherever you are in the world. Stay safe and healthy. I love you.